science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
So unfortunately, we weren't able to get hold of Tracy Martin before, but hopefully we get in touch with her before the end of the show. But for now, we are doing My Final Dear Science, which is one of my, I've come to, you know, initially, Dear Science, I was like, oh my God, I don't know a thing about Dear Science. I just ask all these stupid questions all the time. But it's really, I've come to be very fond of it. Alan?
Oh, that's very nice to hear. I'm sure Steve would be thrilled about that too. So
yes,
thank you.
Carried on his legacy nicely. So some of the stories today. First up, scientists have developed carbon nanotubes that can be used for filtering salt water, which sounds pretty cool. How does this work?
It is. So to sort of truly appreciate this, you have to go back about 30-odd years to some experiments that were being done in the States by a couple of Americans and a British guy. Basically what they were doing were they were taking carbon and heating it up with lasers to very, very high temperatures and seeing what happened, basically. Simple as that. So they're taking soot, essentially. And at that stage, there were only two forms of carbon known. So you've got your diamond and you've got your graphite. Okay, so that's lead in your pencil, basically. So graphite and diamond. Which one's the more stable? Here we go. Test.
Graphite.
Oh, well
diamond.
Done. Well done. Well done, Shamina, on your final show and
shame,
everything.
Will.
See, I wouldn't have asked the question if the answer had been diamond. So, you know, that's because diamonds are forever, apparently. But they're not. And diamonds are inexorably turning into graphite, even though we can't sort of see it. They are. So if you've got a diamond ring, a million years from now...
Well, because isn't the whole thing...
You can
thing,
use it
though,
as a pencil.
Yes, indeed.
Wasn't the whole test of, you know, being able to know the legitimacy of a diamond is being able to, like, you know, crunch it. And if it's legit, then, you know, you're like, yeah, this is good, solid
I think
diamond.
I think of biting gold...
No, it's no. I think you can do it with diamonds. Can't you do it with diamonds?
You'd hurt your teeth. They're the hardest things known. So
yeah. So that's the whole thing. Is that like if it's legit?
If it hurts your teeth,
how long do they stay as the hardest thing known though? If they turn into graphite eventually?
Yeah, there's a few million years in it. It's slow. It's
okay.
Slow. Anyway, this
sorry,
is the background.
Sorry to derail
this is,
you. Yeah. Continue.
But this is the background. So up until that time, there'd only been two known forms of carbon: so diamond and graphite. And these guys came up with some remarkable results. And the one thing, or one of the things they found, was this molecule called C60, which was 60 carbon atoms. And they knew it contained 60 carbon atoms, but they didn't figure out how it was arranged, or it took them a bit of thought anyway. And then eventually they worked out that it's shaped like a soccer ball. So it's got alternating hexagons and pentagons. If you've ever looked closely at a soccer ball, you'll see it's made up a whole lot of different panels and they're alternating hexagons and pentagons. Mm. And it's got 60 vertices in it. And so this thing reminded them of Buckminster Fuller, the famous architect, excuse me, with his geodesic domes. And so they called it Buckminster Fullerene.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
There we go.
From a science book in year 11. There's a whole page about Buckminster Fullerene.
Indeed.
And I even remember that structure.
Yep.
How
yep.
it looked. Anyway, continue.
Okay, good,
continue.
Good. So...
I'm with you, Alan. I'm with you.
So they invented this thing, but then they couldn't find anything really to do with it. Now, if you'd believed the hype at the time it was going to change the world, there was nothing that Buckminster Fullerene wouldn't be able to do, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's been a bit of a disappointment up until now. That did win their discoverers a Nobel Prize in 1996. But... what was also discovered at the time was some other sort of molecules. They weren't quite sure what they were, but in 1991, a Japanese researcher was looking at sort of similar things, and he was the first discoverer of these things called carbon nanotubes. And these carbon nanotubes are basically graphite that is rolled up into tubes, like really, really, really small diameter tubes. Okay, so they're very sort of similar to the Buckminster Fullerene whole sort of thing. They're just pure carbon, but again, they're arranged in tubular form. And so what researchers have very, very recently, i.e. in the last week or so, done, has published a paper looking at these carbon nanotubes. They have made them incredibly thin. So they've got a diameter now of less than a nanometer. And what they're looking at is using these as possible desalination catalysts. So obviously there's parts of the world where fresh water is an issue. Obviously not here. Well, it's an election issue, but we won't go there. But obviously in the tropics, out in the desert, stuff like that, they don't have the fresh water, and so they get fresh water through desalination plants. And currently desalination plants either operate by boiling up the water and condensing the pure water. So you take the seawater, boil it, condense off the pure water. That obviously is very, very energy inefficient because it requires an awful lot of energy to boil water. And the other way is to use a thing called a semi-permeable membrane, where these are special membranes where they apply a pressure to salt water and only the water flows through the membrane. All of the other stuff in the water, which you don't want, which is your sodium ions and your chloride ions and your carbonate ions and all of those sorts of things, they stay on the other side of the barrier. Now, again, it's an energy-intensive method because you've obviously got to apply quite large pressures in order to get the water flowing one way. Okay, so it can be done, and that's the way it's pretty much currently done, is using these membranes. However, this may change the whole thing. Certainly, obviously not right now, but maybe, you know, in a few years' time. So they've made these nanotubes to mimic channels that are found in nature. So in nature, in our cells, water transport is a really important thing. Water transport in and out of cells, excuse me, is really important for various reasons we won't go into. But water transport is done by these proteins called aquaporins. And what they do is they allow water molecules in and out of cells, but in single file, basically. So they are proteins, but they get water flowing through them in single file. And they do that at quite a rapid rate of knots. And again, they also won their discoverers the Nobel Prize as well, the aquaporins. So these guys are trying to mimic nature, essentially, by using these nanotubes. And they're reasoning that the interior of the nanotubes, because it's pure carbon, they're really, really slippery, basically. Whereas the aquaporins aren't. They've got things that can sort of stick to the water a bit. And that's their reasoning. And if they make them narrow enough diameter, they should be able to also get the water molecules going single file down there. And the important thing is that they're too small to let the sodium ions and the chloride ions and the carbonate ions and all that other stuff in seawater through as well. So it's only going to be the water molecules that can actually get down these tubes. And this should be pretty much sort of a zero energy system, because all you're relying upon basically is gravity to pull the water through and excluding everything else at the same time. So what they found is that, yes, this works. They can get water flowing through these things. They can exclude the ions, and they can do it at six times the rate or the speed at which nature can do it with these aquaporins. So if you're doing something faster than nature can do it, then you're pretty much on the right track, I'd say. They've had about a 4.5 billion year head start on us in that respect. So this does sound quite exciting, actually. So these are researchers over at the Lawrence Livermore Lab over in the States, and this was published in Science this week. So
what are some of the uses for this discovery?
Well, that's the use. I mean, basically, if you can get a cheaper method of desalination, you're onto it. So it's the energy inefficiency of the current methods that's the real reason behind this. And if they can get this going in a commercial sense, obviously they've got to upscale it. That's the important thing. We're talking about things that are only a nanometer or 10 or so nanometers long and a nanometer wide. A nanometer, remember, is a thousandth of a millionth of a meter. So not very big at all. So obviously you're going to need lots of these and arranged somehow, and so that you can pass water through them. But, you know, it's certainly a start. And it could be a very, very big discovery, especially for the arid climates parts of the world, you know, your Australia's, your Middle East's, et cetera, et cetera. So
basically being able to turn seawater into fresh water.
Seawater into fresh water, yeah. Yep. So
which will have endless commercial and, I mean, I guess non-commercial possibilities and benefits.
Yes, yeah. Most definitely.
Would you be able to use this to clean dirty water from rivers and things like that as well, or does it not work in the same
potentially,
way?
Yeah, potentially you could. Or it's operating on size. So you're looking at the size of water molecule. If you've got something smaller than a water molecule, then that's going to be able to get down there as well. But the common stuff in seawater, all of the ions in seawater are going to be larger than that, and so therefore it should work very nicely for that. And dirty water, you've got things like particulates and stuff like that, and if you've got particles in there, all they're going to do is clog things up.
True.
That's going to be the problem. So we're talking about basically seawater where everything's dissolved. Mm. Okay, so all of your sodium chlorides and stuff are dissolved in seawater, and so therefore they just physically can't get in, and but they're not going to block it up because they're still floating around in the water, so they're not solids. Aha, there
see,
we go.
That, I was going to ask, how does this work in practice?
Yeah. Light bulb.
I know science. in practice, how would this work? Would it be, how would you make this function in a machine or just as a mechanism? Would it be like a sheet that you place the water
essentially,
on?
That's what they're talking about. So they're trying to immobilize these things sort of on some sort of surface, and they can just pass the water through that.
Yeah, because it's easy to think about them as tiny tubes, but when we see them, they're not going to be tubes. It's going to be a surface that's going to have to pass. Okay.
So it's sort of a similar principle to this semi-permeable membrane thing, except they don't have to exert a pressure to go through. It'll just drip through under gravity. So
it's like amazing. A really tiny grate that you can put water through and it filters it out.
Yeah, pretty
something.
Much. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There we go.
Cool.
Awesome. That's really cool. And so our next story today. It's been discovered that the ancient Babylonians had developed a form of trigonometry that's said to be superior to Pythagoras. So why and why do we only know now?
Well, Will and I were just talking before this about his love of calculus. Not
love it.
So you know, calculus is one of those things that you learn at high school, and so also is trigonometry. And I think it's probably fair to say that neither are particularly beloved by the majority of the students in the class, unless you've got a really shit hot teacher who you know can really teach this stuff. But trigonometry is kind of important, like very, very important, especially if you're going to go on and be something like an engineer or something like that. It crops up absolutely everywhere in science. The places that you least expect it. It's very important in chemistry. You've got sines and cosines. You might not think so, but, you know, they're there. So it's kind of interesting, I guess, to know where trigonometry came from. And sort of the earliest sort of definite, I guess, discovery of trigonometry were the ancient Greeks. And so obviously your Pythagoras's, your Euclid's, Archimedes, Hipparchus, and all of those sorts of guys were thought of as being sort of the developers, the finder-outers, discoverers of trigonometry. But so this... What has happened, I guess, in the last week, again, a paper has been published by some Australian researchers, and they have been studying this clay tablet that was found in southern Iraq sort of in the early 20th century. It's called Plimpton 322, after this guy Plimpton, who bought it off one of these archaeologists who was fossicking around in southern Iraq at that time, and who apparently was the model for Indiana Jones, apparently went and climbed Mount Ararat looking for the Ark and all of this sort of stuff. So that's the backstory to that, yes. So this Babylonian clay tablet was covered with what were previously indecipherable markings, I guess, but have now been interpreted as being numbers. And more so, they've been interpreted as being essentially a set of trig tables. So for those of you listening who had to suffer through trigonometry at school, you'll remember your sines and your cosines and your tangents and all of that sort of stuff. And your right-angled triangles and how if you know one of the angles, then you know, and one of the lengths, then you can get the other one, blah, 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 blah. And as I said, it was the Greeks who originally were thought to have done this, but it looks like possibly the Babylonians might have been doing this 1,000 years earlier than the Greeks. Now, again, that's open to interpretation, but what the Australian researchers also said was that this is possibly a more advanced form of trig than the Greeks had, and it's possibly more advanced than what we currently use today, according to these guys, which does sound rather remarkable. But the basis,
and it's interesting that nobody else has touched on like that, you know, the one developed in Greece has been the one that has been used from then to now.
Yes. Yep.
As opposed to, you know, there's this more ancient version that is actually possibly superior.
Indeed, and I guess the reason for that is that things got lost, I guess, in those days. So, you know, they didn't have the internet.
No, didn't have Twitter, Facebook. Yeah.
I find the craziest thing is we think about ancient world and we think Greece, you know, just prior to, you know, year one, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But these, what, the Babylonians were 3,500 years ago or something
crazy? Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah.
That's ancient. That's ancient history to the ancient Greeks.
Well, you've got civilizations in Turkey sort of, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 years old. And you've got the Aborigines in Australia, you know, we were talking the other day, like 60,000, 60 to 75,000. You know, it's just, I guess, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years ago is relatively recent history, really, when you look at
we
it like that.
We think we're so special, but we really aren't.
So, okay, so are we going to see this new, or old, Babylonian trigonometry appearing in high school textbooks?
I kind of doubt it, I think. Okay. One of the reasons that they think it's so good, or that it's sort of better than perhaps what we use today, is the Babylonians used a different number base system than we do. So we are a decimal system, so we count in tens, okay? And when you count in tens, then there's only two sort of exact fractions when you've got a base 10. So you've got a half, which is 0.5 when you convert it to a decimal, and you've got a fifth, which is 0.2 when you convert that to a decimal. So a third, for example, is 0.3333, you know, repeating. It's not exact in terms of decimal. The Babylonians used a base 60 counting system.
What?
Okay, so you're familiar with base 10, and you're familiar with base 2, which is your binary system, which is used by computers. So the Babylonians went for base 60, so they used 60 as essentially their base for their counting system.
Wow.
Now, what
that's kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, that's hard to wrap your head around, really.
Because it's exactly the same as time. So you think about time. Time is base 60, okay? 60 minutes in an hour.
Yeah.
Okay? 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour. So time is base 60. So you can do addition and everything probably without even knowing it in base 60, you know, because every time you're sort of figuring out how long till whatever, you know, if you go past the 12 o'clock, then that's you're doing things in base 60, okay, so without even knowing it.
Would it be better to do maths in a base higher number, base 60?
I remember when we had this at school and I could never figure out the point. It just didn't make any sense. Perhaps the teacher was crap, or perhaps I was dumb, I don't know, but probably the latter. But so the one of the things about base 60 is that 60, you can divide a lot more numbers into 60 with no remainder than you can into 10. Okay. So 60's got a lot more divisors than 10. So therefore you get a lot more, when you convert them to decimal, you get a lot more exact fractions, essentially. So, and that seems to be the reason why they're saying that it's, you know, a bit different and maybe sort of superior to what we use today. But no, I doubt it's going to make the textbooks somehow. But, you know, I think it's an interesting historical more than a curiosity. What they also reckon is that this tablet's incomplete, that it's broken off, and that really it should have contained more, and they can figure out how much more it would have contained. And they think that they used it as a basis for surveying or building pyramids and stuff and things back, you know, back what they did in those days, back in southern Iraq. So yeah, it's kind of cool.
I mean, it's where they had the Hanging Gardens, which is seven ancient wonders of the world.
Indeed.
So
yep.
They must have been good at some stuff. Even though they are
a
so
lot
old.
Of stuff. Probably much better than a lot of the things we're good at today, to be honest.
Yes, yep, true. They had a lot, they knew a lot less, but a lot of people knew more about a lot less, if you get what I'm saying. So a lot of people were more skilled in a whole lot of different fields, I think, back in the days, whereas now I think there's so much knowledge that you can only specialise in a tiny, tiny little bit. So, you know, the days of the polymath are no more, possibly.
You got to pick and choose your knowledge.
Absolutely, yes. Yep.
Areas that you're going to get into.
Going back to our theme on education.
Yeah. Well, indeed. As we were saying, though, before, oh, my goodness. Sorry, just flung my headphone cord across the studio. But yeah, I mean, I guess still it kind of comes down to what we were talking about before, that literacy is still like a really key part in accessing a lot of knowledge.
Well, reading, writing and arithmetic, you know, the three R's, they are kind of important.
Also, we can carve our own tablets for the future to work out how smart we were.
Nice analogy. There we go. That's good.
Anyway, before this nose dives even further, shall we move on to the third story? We've got a chemist who is known for being a supervisor for Ernest Rutherford. Mm-hmm. This chemist who was the supervisor was born today in 1851 and was also known for winning a Nobel Prize in chemistry. So who is this man?
Oh, you've nearly got it. I think something got garbled when I sent it through to you. So August the 30th, okay? So it's a big day today.
Okay, yes, yep.
So Ernest Rutherford was born on August the 30th in 1871. Okay. And people always go on about the fact that there's a dearth of public holidays between Queen's Birthday and Labor Day. So why the hell don't we have Rutherford's birthday as a national holiday?
So there this is go. Nothing, this story has nothing to do with the chemist.
Oh, no, it is. It is. Okay. I'm getting to that.
All right.
I've got Wikipedia open here. It says this guy, how do you even say it? Jacobus Henricus Vantoff was born today as well.
He was. But I'm getting to that.
Okay. Well, me and Will will zip it, and you just take it from here, Alan.
So Rutherford was born on 30th of August. Okay. Now, his PhD supervisor, J.J. Thompson, died on the 30th of August. That's okay. So that's kind of a little link. And he also outlived Rutherford, which is kind of unusual. So a PhD supervisor outliving someone. So we've got a birth on 30th of August, we've got a death on the 30th of August, and we've also got another birth on the 30th of August, who was a chemist by the name of Vantoff. Okay, Jacobus Vantoff. And his claim to fame, the reason I'm bringing him up, I think it's really interesting because I always tell this story to all my first year lectures or in my first year lectures to all the first year kids who are sort of age 17, 18 or whatever. And this guy, Vantoff, came up with an idea that absolutely revolutionized chemistry, and he was 22 years old at the time. And it's all got to do with your hands. So look carefully at your hands and you'll see that they are mirror images of each other. Okay. Now, try and put one hand on top of another so that they become indistinguishable.
It doesn't work, Alan.
It doesn't work. Now, Chimina's gone there and she's put the bottom hand on the back and the top hand on the front. Now you think they're indistinguishable, aren't they?
Yes.
But they're not, because you've still got a left hand and a right hand. Now, you can't do it like that, okay? So, the left hand and the right hand are examples of what we call non-superimposable mirror images, okay? Or in chemistry parlance, we call them enantiomers. That's a good word for you. Now, enantiomers are really, really important because molecules can exist as enantiomers, okay? So actual molecules can exist as non-superimposable mirror images of each other. And you might think, well, so what? You know, why is that at all important? It's important. Okay, so I'm going to go out on a limb here and mention thalidomide. Have we heard of thalidomide?
Yes.
Good. Okay.
I can't tell you anything about it.
Okay. So
other than maybe we've talked about it on Dear Science before,
I think possibly might have. Mm. But just to refresh the memory, so thalidomide was a drug given to pregnant women in the late 50s, early 60s.
That's right. Okay.
There we go.
Okay.
Ring bells.
And all the birth defects and everything that happened. Okay.
That's right.
So the thing about thalidomide is that its molecules could exist as non-superimposable mirror images of each other. Okay. So that's why it's important. And nature itself has all of these molecules that have particular what we call handedness. They're either left-handed or right-handed. So all of our DNA, for example, only coils one way, okay? So the double helix goes one way, it doesn't go the other way. You don't get the mirror image of DNA in nature. Proteins are made up of amino acids, and amino acids have got a particular handedness. So one of them exists in nature, the other one basically doesn't. But they're exactly identical, apart from the fact that you can't
superimpose them.
The mirror images, okay? So this came from this guy Vantoff all the way back in about 1874 or something like that, when he was 22 years old, and he figured out, using the very, very limited knowledge of the day, that these molecules could exist as non-superimposable mirror images of each other. There were two possibilities for how to arrange four things around a carbon atom, and he correctly figured out that one of these would lead to these things being mirror images of each other that you couldn't put on top of each other, and that could have very, very important ramifications in chemistry. And in organic chemistry, it's got enormous ramifications. In biology, it's got enormous ramifications. And it all came from this guy who was 22 years old when he came up with this idea, which just strikes me as utterly remarkable. Those of you who are listening and not chemists possibly don't appreciate this as much as I do, possibly. But it was a quite revolutionary idea at the time. And he did end up getting the Nobel Prize. He was the first ever Nobel Prize in chemistry winner in 1901, and he actually didn't get it for that work. He got it for other work, which just goes to show how remarkable he is. So there you go, the 30th of August, a quite great day for science. But you know, Rutherford's birthday, there we go, national holiday. I reckon.
Let's do it.
What do people think? Come on. Twitter,
tell us.
Text us. You know.
Text us in. Should today be a public holiday?
But only text us if the answer is yes.
No, tell us everything. Tell us all your thoughts. You usually do anyway, dear listeners.
I'm going to make a Twitter poll. So go on to Twitter.
Go to the 95BFM News Twitter and cast your vote. But yes, so that is all for today. But do you remember, Alan, last week how we spoke about... We spoke about doing a whiskey tasting.
We did indeed. That did come up.
Yes. We did speak about that. Well, if you stick around a little bit longer when our wire show crosses over with Bridget's show, we might have something in store for you, Alan.
Well, that sounds excellent. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you, Shamina, and I wish you all the very best in your new venture. And do well.
Thanks, Alan.
And I'm sure you will.
It's been fun working with you too.
Thanks.
That was Dear Science.